Sometimes when I encounter a situation that might lead to a conflict, I would think I'm just a fool. As a way to prevent conflict and to let go of my attachment to personal views and opinions. Is this the correct way of practice? Might it lead to a negative form of self-view?
So in living in society, we try to kind of avoid these situations of conflict or dispute, arguments. Because if everyone thinks that my views are correct, my thoughts are correct, and everyone else is wrong, then this will cause a lot of difficulty. And so if we then have this idea, or bring up this thought that I am foolish or stupid, then that can avoid conflicts and we can let go. But we need to understand the meaning of, kind of being a fool, that really there's, that if one is intelligent, but one attaches to that intelligence, then that will create agitation and chaos. And so we need to have this intelligence in terms of the Dhamma, which means that we don't argue with others and we maintain our precepts and our moral integrity. We don't get involved with conflict with others. We have mindfulness and kindness and wisdom. So you shouldn't look at this kind of in a negative light. So there was a teaching that Venerable Ajahn Chah gave, which is that if people come at us, or if the experiences come at us and are very high, then we need to try to avoid those. We need to go in a different way. So if they come high, then we go low. And if they come in low, then we go higher. So we don't have any problems when that happens. So we're avoiding this conflict there. So don't look down on yourself when you have this idea as well. You know, thinking that I'm foolish, I'm stupid, I'm not good. And that what you're doing is finding a way to avoid these arguments and conflicts and difficulty. And there's sila there, you have this virtue. So what you're doing is correct.
I am a practitioner who loves all kinds of animals, and I have been spending years as a volunteer to lobby the Thai government to set up animal welfare laws to protect captive wild animals in the zoos from neglect or poor conditions, and laws to regulate dogs breeding to give these animals better living conditions. Right now, Thailand has none of those laws. Buddhists have a saying, all sentient beings must abide by their karma. Most people who like to say that have not done much to help the animals. What should I do to somehow maintain my equanimity while helping these poor animals? It is difficult to actively help and not be attached to the outcomes at the same time. Since there are animals subject to cruel treatment every day, including those eaten as food by humans, even dogs are eaten in some countries.
So I give my anumodana to you. So rejoice in the heart of kindness and compassion that you have, having this goodwill for all beings, wishing them to be happy. This love for all beings, all animals, and compassion to help them, wishing that they don't have any suffering. So going about that, you know, in the way of trying to change some laws. But with this not suffering, that we try to help beings to not suffer, but there can be some problems that arise. Those problems come up when we just can't do anything, that we're not able to help them. And we're also not able to bring up equanimity, not able to let go of that. So we need to kind of not kind of look so much at other people, that they're like this or they're like that. And the saying that all beings follow their karma, the meaning of that is that we're not able to help them, that we've tried already, we've have this goodwill towards them already, but we simply can't help. And so we have to just allow them to follow their karma. So as Buddhists, we have kindness towards beings, towards animals, and towards fish and cows and dogs, chickens, pigs. They have this kindness that if they are going to be sold to be killed, then one may buy them and then release them. But we may buy them all, so say, all the animals in one marketplace and release those, but then there's another marketplace, there's a second one, and a third one, and a fourth one, and a fifth one. And then in other districts, they have more markets. And then in other provinces, they have even more markets. And there are even more markets in different countries. And so we simply aren't able to help all of them because there are just so many of these beings. So we need to come back and we need to just help as much as we're able to, following our means, following our energy. And when we can't help, then we reflect that beings must follow their karma. So try to look at this in a way that's balanced, that's just right. Because if you kind of overthink the situation and try to help too much in a way that's beyond your energy and your capabilities, then you'll suffer. And what that shows is that you're not helping yourself. And so there's this kindness there, being to have kindness for yourself as well, so that suffering doesn't arise within your own heart. And when you're not able to do anything, then in the end, you need to let go.
Dear Longpa, you have spoken on several occasions about seeing Dhamma. Could you please clarify what this means and how one can recognize when they are prepared to perceive the Dhamma? Does it imply that our knowledge prior to experiencing this insight is merely theoretical, confined to book learning?
So with seeing the Dhamma, what Dhamma is nature. So we're seeing nature in line with its truth. So like when Digganaka Brahman listened to the Dhamma of the Buddha, he could accept the truth. And by accepting truth, he saw the Dhamma. So seeing that all physicality or mentality has the nature to arise, stay for a bit, and cease. And so it's normal for it to be like this. When Anya Kondanya listened to the Dhamma of the Buddha, what he understood was that all things that are of the nature to arise are of the nature to cease. So he saw this arising and ceasing, that there's no me there, there's nothing, there's no me that could be taken as a self. But if we don't see the Dhamma, then we see things in terms of self. And when we see things in terms of self, then we have craving and attachment. And so suffering will come up very frequently. But if we see that all physical and mental things are not self, in line with their reality, with wisdom, then suffering will reduce through that. Because of our changing of views from wrong view into right view. So now we see the body as being me. But as we practice, we see it as not me. We see its reality. And so the people who have seen this, so with their minds, so they see this truth. But in the beginning, we don't know that. We don't see that. There's just me and mine constantly. But however, when we come to study the Dhamma, we begin to gain an understanding of this nature. And we chant, for example, and listen to teachings. And what we hear is that physical and mental things are inconstant, they're stressful, they're not self. But we still don't understand that clearly, do we? That there's just this understanding in terms of what we've listened to and what we've read. And some people believe what they hear, some people don't. But there's still an inability to resolve the suffering that we experience. And we still suffer like we did before. And the wisdom that arises, it's just a tiny amount, that which comes from from the study of just hearing and reading. But if we take what we've read and we've heard and we think about that, we contemplate it, then we begin to understand into this nature of not-self. We think, well, things that just arise, stay for a little bit and then cease, how could that possibly be me? But still that understanding, it's not clear, it's still hazy, it's murky. So we can say it's like during the time of sunset, maybe about 6:30 p.m. And things get very hazy, they're not clear. Things which are far away from us, we're not able to see them. And then as it gets darker and darker, and objects which are just 1 or 2 meters away from us, that there's no light around, we're not able to see anything. We can't see anything at all. But if there's light that comes up, then we're able to see clearly, we know what's there. So the knowledge that we gain from listening and from thinking, it's like this. But actually seeing the Dhamma, it's like there's a great brightness and a clarity to that. And just like when the sun comes up and it's high in the sky, then we can see all the things around us. You can see the mountains and the trees, the birds. If we're walking along a path, we're able to see what's on that path so we can walk along it safely. If there are any snakes, we can avoid them. And so we see that path ahead of us. And so this is even more the case for seeing the path within our own hearts and seeing the Dhamma in our own hearts. So the truth already is this way. Physical and mental things already are this way, that they're not constant, that they're stressful, that they're not self. That they already are like this. But it's just that our minds are dark, aren't they? So we don't see. We can give the comparison of being like someone whose eyesight is not good, that they have problems with their eyes that need to be cured. And when they can cure those eye issues, then they can see, and they can see clearly. So for us, we need to cure our hearts. The heart which is dark, we need to make it bright. So we do that with samadhi, firstly. Or if we're selfish, then we give. We have this generosity and sila, firstly. And then we come to meditate in order to bring the mind to peace. And when we do this, then we see and know little by little. We steadily gain this understanding within ourselves, beginning to understand the Dhamma. And begin to understand and see that there really isn't a self there. And when we can see that, there's a great ease in the body and in the mind becomes very light. And in that state, then our sila, our virtue becomes more stable. We're more consistently generous. Samadhi becomes even more firm, and wisdom grows until one day sila, samadhi, and panya, this virtue, collectedness, and wisdom all gather together and we see clearly. So what we see is nature, which means that we see the Dhamma. And so we don't see anything else other than what's already here already. These things are here already, but we just don't see them, which is the problem. We see them, but we don't see them clearly. But by seeing them clearly, that means is that we see the Dhamma. So in the beginning, we gain this knowledge from reading and from thinking. But that isn't yet able to give us clarity. But it's when we meditate that we gain a clear knowledge that arises.
Dear Longpa Anand, could you please explain the Buddha simile of the tortoise and the jackal in relation to the development of a peaceful mind? Just as the tortoise pulls its limbs into its shell, so pulls the monk his mind's thoughts in. Independent and going after no one, he becomes desireless and griefless. With sincere respect and gratitude, may Tanajan be well.
So this is one of the suttas from the 84,000 Dhamma teachings that the Buddha gave. So this sutta, it's about a tortoise and a jackal. And so both of them going looking for food in the same place by the bank of a body of water. And when the jackal comes close to the tortoise knows that this is a dangerous situation. So it pulls its head in, it pulls its legs in order to protect itself. And the jackal, it goes right up to the tortoise and is waiting there, thinking that as soon as it puts its head out, then I'll bite its head. And then I'll smash its shell, and I'll be able to eat this. But the tortoise, it's careful, it's not heedless, and so it doesn't put its head out. And when that's the case, then the jackal can't do anything to it. So it has to go off and search for food elsewhere. So the Buddha gave this simile to being like monks or lay people who desire peace, that they should have good composure and restraint of their hearts. Because when the eye sees a form, or the ears hear sounds, the nose contacts odors, the tongue with flavors, the body with tactile sensations, or the mind contacts Dhamma aramanas, these objects that appear within the mind. Then what's happening is the heart is receiving these sensory experiences. And we need to be very careful at that point, because this is where the defilements arise. The sense of self arises here, craving and clinging arise here. And if we aren't cautious and restrained, it's like the turtle has put its head out from its shell, and that is a threat to its life. And so the monks who don't restrain their minds, for them, the defilement, the mara of defilement will catch them. But if we restrain ourselves well, then we have an energy there to the heart. And the mind won't fall into these emotions or experiences which are involved with craving. And so there isn't this, so it doesn't get involved in this craving. Views can't be firmly established, and we don't harm other beings. And in the end, one attains to arahantship, and there's this complete cessation. And so this teaching, the sutta, it's explaining mindfulness, composure, caution, not allowing the mind to get involved in liking and disliking. When the sense organs experience a sense object, you carry on doing that until samadhi becomes well established and wisdom arises, and we're able to attain to complete freedom from suffering.